current culture, I think there's a culture of children should never hurt. So when someone says, I'm afraid my child will be hurt, I always question that. Well, yeah, your kid is going to experience hurt. It's part of life to be hurt.
Yes.
Sometimes kids need hurt feelings so they can learn how to deal with hurt feelings.
The argument I often get is that the other parent has poor parenting skills and therefore they're going to hurt my child. And what I try to explain is, this is an opportunity for you. You are going to be able to equip your child with some things that non-divorced children may never get their hands on as far as skill sets are concerned.
Yeah.
So your child could really thrive depending on what you do with another parent who doesn't have good parenting skills.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Diane Dirks.
And I'm Rick Voiles.
We've been working with co-parents in conflict for more than two decades. We've taught classes, written books, counseled parents, empathized, and agonized a few times to help people make sense of their complicated families.
We were talking one day, and it occurred to us that helping the most difficult cases comes down to one simple concept. Is one parent willing to let go of the tug-of-war rope, or is it worth it to hold on and fight?
So we invite you to take this journey with us each episode as we tackle the questions, should you hold on or let it go?
Welcome to Co-Parent Dilemmas, where we give you practical solutions to those impossible co-parents. Hello, Diane again.
Hello, Rick. You sound a little raspy.
I am raspy, and this is the best I've been in 4 days. So it's better and better. And so tomorrow I'm going to be perfect.
Was it flu or cold?
It was a head cold. I tested negative. So it was just a head cold.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. So you'll just have to sound nasally.
Raspy.
Yeah. Or your voice is a little deeper than usual.
Yeah, my Charlton Heston voice or something. Who?
Our listeners have no idea who Charlton Heston is.
Yes.
I mean, Bradley Cooper.
There you go.
So today we're going to answer a very interesting question that came from Danny. And I actually like this question, which is why I chose it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of his questions, is how we choose things.
Right? Yes.
So he says, I have been listening to the show and I'm wondering how you decide what dilemmas to choose. It seems that you have been living in my house and reading all of my emails. I'm assuming some things are common to every high conflict situation. So that's why I don't feel mine is so unique when I listen to the podcast. Could you give us the top three issues that high conflict parents deal with and how you advise? Thanks for all you do. That's a great question.
Yeah.
It's funny. He says, it feels like you've been living in my house. When I used to teach the classes in the courthouse, I can't tell you how many people would come up to me afterward. Oh my gosh, how do you know so much about my life?
Right. Yeah, we get that a lot. Yep.
Which was kind of code for saying, it's kind of nice to know I'm not the only one.
Right. That you understand me. Right. Yeah.
And I think that's, Rick, really the appeal of this podcast is that people listen because they want to feel like they're not alone.
Yes.
They're not the only one dealing with an impossible co-parent.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully they listen to some of our advice. And it sounds like Danny wants to know, number one, how we choose dilemmas, but then what we think are common, like the top three.
Yeah.
So it caused me to do a little bit of thinking.
Those are the ones we like. Well. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. What am I going to say about this? Because there's a lot that we could say, but you and I have talked about this many times, that after doing this for so many years, there are not 1,000 different issues.
No.
There are 1,000 different scenarios that boil down to about a half a dozen issues.
Yes.
And after a while, you start to realize we just boil it down. So for our listeners, they're dealing with the topic of the day or the week or the month.
Mm-hmm.
but it probably boils down into one of our categories.
Yeah.
I thought it might be helpful to answer Danny's question and figure out what are those categories. And if they, as co-parents, can begin to see through that lens of the real issues instead of the topic of the day.
Right.
And fighting about that, fighting about the facts, and instead kind of put it in a category that's more manageable, or more gets to the heart of the matter, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, because you and I don't typically advise, okay, so you're having a conflict. This came up recently in one of my dilemmas of the week on social media, that the other parent wants you to pay for the school lunch account because you're the one who gets the child support. And the, but you never, you always make your child's lunch for school. And they, while they're with you, they never access that account. So in your mind, you're thinking, well, you pay for it because I'm using my food at home.
Right.
And we've heard that conflict before, and you and I could give, if we were mediating this conflict, we might give some practical ways to compromise on that issue. Why don't you do X and you do Y, and then we'll achieve Z. And that would be one way to address the actual issue. But what's more important to me is, why is this a conflict?
Why is this an issue? Yes.
Why is it an issue? What's really happening here? What really matters to the child?
Right.
And is this something that you need to worry about for the future? Or is it something you can put in perspective? Does that make sense? So let's answer Danny's first question, which is, how do we choose? How do we choose, Rick?
Well, I think we've well, really, when it boils down to, we aren't all into the salacious. We're into how, what would practically help the most people.
Right. So we do try to choose conflicts that are common.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously we try to choose conflicts that we haven't done in a little while.
Sure.
Because if we started repeating the same kind of conflict over and over, people would get bored. So we try to bring variety to it. I like when people send us emails or voicemails where they're actually questioning their own behavior.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very attracted to that. You know, I think I might be wrong, or am I doing the wrong thing? Or what if I really messed up here? You know, because to me, that's a person who really is interested in learning. And it makes me want to help them. If I get an email where somebody's blame, 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 please put this on your show so you can agree with me, I tend to shy away from those. What about you?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Because I'm thinking, oh, you don't really want the answer to that. You just want us to agree with you, and we're probably not. And then you're going to be bad and write a bad review.
Or you just want a stage, right, to vent.
Right. So if you have a dilemma and you're trying to get it aired on the show, one of the ways to do that is to be honest about, you know, how you've handled it, and really show us that you want help with an issue, not just wanting to blame the other parent, but also an issue that truly is a dilemma.
Yeah.
You know, I get some emails that I'm thinking, this is a no-brainer. Why are you even asking me this question? And then I get some that I'm like, yeah, that could be an issue or a problem. I could see how there are multiple things going on that could cause this to be difficult to resolve. So I guess that's the quick answer of how we choose. We want it to be helpful to as many people as possible. We want it to be common. We want to have a variety of conflicts to talk about. And we like humble questions.
Humble people. Yes.
So the next one is a bigger item. He wants us to list the top three issues facing high conflict co-parents. And right away, I'm thinking, again, we're not going to put this in terms of topics, you know, parenting time or child support or medical decisions. We could say those are topics, but I honestly can't say there's a top three, because some high conflict co-parents turn everything into a conflict.
Right. Yes. It's not a, yeah, it's about the other parent or it's about them. It's not about the topic at hand. Right.
Yes. So my brain kind of went to what are the top three things that drive conflict? Mm-hmm. What are the top three fears or threats that cause people to feel like they need to fight for something?
Right.
Whether it's the lunch account or the birthday cupcakes or the passport or the spring break or the, you know, we could name 1,000 different topics, but what really drives the conflict? And I actually came up with four.
Okay.
Because I had trouble not having that fourth one. And they can all be interconnected, obviously.
Sure.
I think probably the top fear that drives conflict is fear of losing my children.
Yes.
Either physically or emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big one. I would put number two, fear of losing myself.
Yes.
A lot of conflicts are, well, I'm not going to give in to that because I gave in during the marriage and I need to show him or her that I'm not a doormat, you know, and that's all of that is driven by, I'm afraid of losing myself because I worked so hard to regain myself after I left the relationship, right?
Right. Yes. Or even a parenting issue, my image of myself as a good mom or a good dad. In other words, I have to have 50-50. And the real reason is I don't see myself as a good father if I can't have 50-50. And so they're fighting for their personal self-image.
Right, right. Number three would be fear that my children will be permanently scarred somehow.
Yeah.
So the worry that whatever is happening is going to affect them long term, and I've got to protect them. So it's sort of a protective conflict, right?
Yes.
Got to fight for my children because no one else will fight for them. And if I don't fight for them, they will be harmed in some way.
Yeah. I've got to have this thing or my child won't get, you know, something that my child. Well, remember the birthday illustration we keep using for the plan B?
Right.
You know, the mom at first is fighting to get dad to take him to the birthday because this is part of his socialization and this is his best friend and it's going to, you know, he's going to be hurt for the rest of his life. Those kind of arguments. So either it's something I want to have happen or it's something I don't want the other parent to do or keep doing because it will scar my children. Right. Bad parenting scars children.
Yeah. Not always.
No, I mean, if it, either that or we're all scarred.
Yes, because there are no perfect parents.
No.
So number four might be an overarching umbrella over the rest of them, or it could be stand on its own, but fear of the court bankrupting me.
Oh, man. Yes.
People have a huge fear of court, especially when they have a co-parent who's not afraid of court.
Yeah,
all kinds of resources to go to court and the fear. So I may, but I think oftentimes that causes you to not fight and give in more because you're afraid of the court.
Oh, well, then you lose yourself back to.
Right. So that dilemma of how the court plays into those other three issues, right?
Yeah, I've seen people fight with because they don't have a fear for the court and they should have a fear.
Don't. Well, they don't even respect the court because regardless of what the court order says, they're going to violate it.
Yeah, that. But I do see the naive person on the other hand thinking, well, if I could just get in front of the judge and tell my story and surely the judge is going, I'm going to, you know, and they don't understand that they could lose an awful lot here. Yeah.
So I want to focus on the three. Knowing that court is in the mix always.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the three of fear of losing my kids, fear of losing myself, and fear that my kids will be permanently scarred somehow. If you think of those three issues as pretty much driving every conflict,
mm-hmm.
Then the next layer I want us to look at is my fear rational or irrational? Ooh, is it rooted in probabilities or is it rooted in possibilities?
Yeah, this is going to get tricky. Because if I'm, so for example, I might have a mom who is fighting because her image of herself as a good mom. Well, is the possibility of being a bad mom a real possibility or a real probability in her mind?
It depends on what she has done.
Or what she's fighting to be able to do, I guess.
Because yeah. I can think of some alienating parents, alienating moms. Yeah. Who may have a fear of how they look, but the actual things they are doing make it a probability that they will, that will become a self-fulfilling prophecy of you ending up looking like a bad parent because you're alienating your kids from the other parent.
Right. Self-fulfilling prophecy. I've seen that. Yeah.
So the reason I think those two things, is it a possible or probable root, is that if the fear is rooted in probability, then we need a practical solution to it.
Yes.
If the fear is rooted in possibility, you may need to change your thinking about the conflict.
Okay. I like the way this is unfolding. Yeah.
Okay. So think of it as a tree. We got the top three things. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're at the bottom. Think of it as a triangle.
The roots. Oh, okay.
The three at the bottom are the fears. The next layer is it possibility or probability? And then the top layer is how you would approach that each one.
Practical or reframe.
Yeah. So, for instance, let's use the example you just talked about. There's a mom who's afraid that she's going to be viewed as a bad mom. Mm-hmm. But she's done everything the way she should. She's followed the court order. She's allowed the kids to have a good relationship with the other parent. She's doing everything possible. Is her fear rooted in probability? If she's afraid to make a decision or she stays in conflict, is it rooted in probability? Probably not, because everything she's doing does not indicate she's a bad mom. So we may have to change her thinking.
Yeah.
But the mom who's actually alienating the children from the other parent, her fear is rational because it's not going to bode well for her in the court or elsewhere if she continues to alienate her children from the other parent. So the answer there is not a reframe. The answer there is stop doing that. Yeah. It's a very practical, you need to change some behavior.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does make sense.
Okay. Hey, listeners, we've got some exciting news. Starting March 6th, I'll be hosting Hump Day Help every Wednesday at noon Eastern Standard Time via Zoom. Each Wednesday will be focused on a specific topic. The first Wednesdays of the month will focus on parental alienation. The second Wednesdays will focus on parents dealing with false allegations. The third Wednesdays will be about surviving a narcissistic co-parent. And fourth Wednesdays, confronting post-separation control and abuse. You can come to one or all. The only requirement is that you become a Patreon non-impossible VIP. The cost is only $10 a month, but I guarantee you'll get your money's worth out of these support groups. We'll run them through the end of May, and if attendance is constant, we'll continue through the summer. So get started today with Patreon. The link is in the show notes. So let's talk about a couple other scenarios to apply this to, because I want to test this. This is something that just kind of entered my head.
Yeah.
So now I have a hypothesis.
Yeah, we're making it up as we go along.
I know. And I want to test this conflict hypothesis when it comes to high conflict co-parenting. And so give me another scenario, a conflict that's, the alienation is a pretty big deal. Let's talk about something on a smaller scale.
All right. Let's say a passport issue.
Okay.
Who gets to hold the passport?
And the fear might be, if I don't keep the passport, he or she might kidnap my children.
Yes.
Okay. And that's a really difficult fear to live with. So let's play that out for the person who has that fear. Is it rational or is it not rational? Is it rooted in probability or rooted in possibility?
Let's say that the other parent only travels out of the country once a year or something. I mean, they don't travel a lot. They don't have access to international travel. They don't even have a lot of money. So then I would start to think, well, this seems a little improbable that they're going to.
Okay. It's possible.
Right.
Maybe not probable.
Right.
So if it's possible and not probable, the answer is maybe you need to rethink
it.
How you approach that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes right down to it, nobody's going to do anything until it happens anyway.
Yeah, that
the judge is not going to rule in your favor based on a possibility. You have it could happen.
That's right? True. Right, it's true. The court doesn't rule on possibilities, right?
But if it's probable because the person that you had a child with is not even a citizen of this country and they're just here on a visa and they live in a different country.
Yeah.
Or they have a history of having taken the kids and not returned them when they were supposed to and kept them from you.
Yeah.
You know, those are things you could possibly make in court and the judge might go, yeah, flight risk.
Yes.
If this person is a flight risk, then, you know, the answer might be more practical. Yes, it might be better if you kept the passport because your fear is more rooted in probability than in possibility.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Let's do another one. We've talked about the fear of losing my kids and losing myself. Let's talk about one where your fear is kids being permanently scarred.
Okay. So how about medication? So the other parent doesn't believe the diagnosis and will not administer the medication during their parenting time.
Okay. And what is the diagnosis?
The ones I see the most would be ADHD or autism.
Okay. So, and the fear of a child being permanently scarred, let's unpack that. How might the child not getting ADHD medication, for instance, permanently scar the child?
Well, this child then is not going to be it's going to affect their behavior in public or at school during that parent's parenting time. Or if the medication isn't administered, like with autism, then the child is going to misbehave and then be labeled and ostracized and socially damaged.
Okay. So I think that's a tough one. Because that's kind of on the fence, right?
Okay.
Let me come back to that one and give an example that's a little bit more cut and dry.
Okay.
And then we're going to come back to that one because I think that's an important and common issue.
Yes.
So let's say your child had strep throat and he or she has 10 days of antibiotics they must take.
Okay.
And
yes.
You give them the first 5 days.
Yes.
And the other parent says, I don't believe in antibiotics.
Right.
What is the possible issue there?
The child won't get well. Extended illness.
Extended illness, or, you know, the antibiotic will, you know, the reason you have to take all of it is so that you make sure you kill all the really, really hardy bacteria.
Yes.
Because if you don't kill, you know, it always kills the weak ones first. Uh-huh. And then by the 7th day or 10th day, it's killing the tough ones.
Yes.
If you don't kill those tough ones, then the tough bacteria will come back like a vengeance and you'll have a worse sickness than you started with. Or maybe later down the road, the antibiotic might not work.
Right. Yes.
Because it doesn't work on those superbugs, right?
Yes.
So that's a real issue and real fear.
Mm-hmm.
Another one I can think of is anti-anxiety or anti-depression medicine.
Right.
It really is not good to go on and off, on and off, on and off that.
No.
It could cause suicidal ideation and behaviors in children. So once a child starts on an anti-anxiety medication or antidepressant, and one parent says, I'm not going to give it to him this weekend, that could be very detrimental.
Right.
To a child, it could even lead to their death. So in those cases, those are high probabilities that your child could really be harmed by that conflict, right? So I would say that's something you fight for. That's something you may say to your child, you know, your mom or dad might forget. So I'm going to give you these extra antibiotic and make sure you take them and just hope that your child remembers.
Right.
Without saying, you tell your dad I said, none of that.
No, no.
Especially if they're old enough, let's say 10 or above, that they might be responsible enough to actually take it. If they're younger than that, it actually might be a legal issue for you if this happens repeatedly.
Yeah.
Because over time, that's going to harm your child for one parent to be giving medication and the other one not to. So let's hop back to the ADHD. What we know about ADHD meds is that they have a really quick half-life. And, you know, you can take it and then it wears off and then you take it again the next day and it wears off. It doesn't build up in your system. It's
right.
One of those medications you can go off of pretty quickly most of the time. Obviously, check with your doctor or physician about that. So in that regard, there are situations where one parent's house, they don't take the ADHD meds. And in the other parent's house, they do. And so the possibility is there that your child could really suffer later on, but it's probably not probable.
Not scarred.
Right. Especially if you intervene in ways to help the child learn coping skills when they're at the other parent's home and you make accommodations and you teach your child that, okay, when you're on the medication, you know, you're going to have a little easier time at school, or you'll be able to concentrate or focus a little bit better. When you're at the other parent's house, let's talk about ways to help you manage it a little bit better. We also know that ADHD is on a continuum, right?
Yes.
From mild to severe, and kids that are mildly to moderately affected, often a physician will not put them on medication. Because of the side effects.
Yes.
The way it changes personality and it affects their eating and all kinds of things like that. So oftentimes they won't even medicate them. But if a child is moderately to severely affected by ADHD, it's almost abusive to not medicate them for the reasons you explained.
You know,
they start to feel different. Why can't I grasp this? All my classmates are grasping. Why can't I pay attention? Why can't I, you know, all of that can really affect their self-esteem. But it doesn't have to be detrimental if you're the parent paying attention. What will be more detrimental is for you to fight with their parent about them.
Right. Okay. Right? Yes. Yep.
So you have to really balance, is this conflict, if the probability is high that my child will be harmed, of course you do something very practical and helpful to try to get them what they need. If it's merely a possibility, then maybe the fight will be worse than your fear that they'll be scarred.
Yes. That,
Am I making sense?
Yeah, let me dissect that just a little bit, because oftentimes when I'm in the middle of this parent arguing or fighting, it's not about the probability or possibility in regards to the child's outcome. They want to tell me that there's a high probability that the parent will forget. And they're measuring not the impact on the child, but the behavior of the other parent that I'm trying to control.
Yes. But again, which medications are you talking about?
And again, why are you focusing on the other parent? You don't have any control. I would say we that's a poor stopping point. Yeah. You need to go think past the other parent's behavior and what is the consequences on the child. And then the probability possibility application becomes a better applicable.
Yes. So then I want to add something at the very top of that triangle now.
Okay.
Child development and knowledge thereof.
I love it.
If you are not clear about your child's age and stage of development and what they need, you could miss the mark.
Yes.
So can you think of examples where parents assume something about a child, but they've got the stage of development all wrong?
Oh, I'd say probably the one I see the most is they start applying rational capabilities, and then they argue, well, they need to know the truth. My child's really mature for a 6-year-old, mm-hmm. And they're talking to them and treating them like they're a 14-year-old.
Yeah. So they're parentifying or adultifying
yes.
their child, right? And the same is true when you infantilize. In other words, bring your child down to a level he's matured beyond and try to keep them very young. We see parents do that who have a fear of ever losing their children. It's one thing to have a fear of losing your child to the other parent. It's a whole other thing, a fear of losing your child ever.
Man.
We have kids and that's the goal, that they go away, right?
Yeah.
Not completely, but partially out of our homes, into their own homes. And then we have a different relationship. But for parents who their children are their complete identity, mm-hmm. and they have no other identity outside of their children, it is very scary for them to go into high school and on to college and the fear of me no longer having someone to take care of is a real fear for a lot of people, but it's a dysfunctional fear. It's a dysfunctional behavior that ensues because of it. You know, helicopter parents.
Yeah.
Parents who can't let their kids go to college without me still doing your assignments to make sure you get straight A's. You know, because the real fear is you're going to leave me and start your own life. And then I'm stuck with what? Myself.
Myself. Right? Yeah.
So, and maybe there's also a fear of losing myself in that as well.
Sure.
Because myself is identified wholly as a parent and not anything else. Mm-hmm. You know? So those are things that drive, I think, the high conflict co-parent.
Yes.
Those more self-destructive behaviors, fears, losing my child, fears of losing myself, wrapped in what looks like the fear my child will be harmed.
Right.
Because often that protective stance that people stand on, well, I've got to protect my child, is code for I'm trying to not lose myself.
Yes.
Or lose my identity.
I hear it all the time. I'm fighting for my child. Mm-hmm. And that you don't understand that it's the fight that hurts your children.
Yeah. And there's also, I don't know what you think about this, Rick, but it's worth talking about in our current culture. I think there's a culture of children should never hurt. So when someone says, I'm afraid my child will be hurt, I always question that. Well, yeah, your kid is going to experience hurt. It's part of life to be hurt.
Yes.
Whether they're hurt permanently is yet another thing. So that's why I added that scarred permanently.
Right. Yeah.
And not fear that my child will be hurt. Because you can do a lot of crazy things to keep your child from experiencing hurt, and you really do them a disservice.
A very bad disservice, yes.
Yeah. So when you're in conflict with your other parent about something solely because you don't want your child's feelings to get hurt, you know, really think through that. Sometimes kids need hurt feelings so they can learn how to deal with hurt feelings. Now, of course, it depends on the scenario. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that blanketly on everything, but I think we do have a culture of no one should ever experience hurt. And I don't think that's instructive.
No, the argument I often get is one parent convincing me or trying to convince me that the other parent has poor parenting skills. They are not a good parent, and therefore they're going to hurt my child. And the argument, well, what I try to explain is, well, first of all, it's not against the law to not have parenting skills. And right. Second, this is an opportunity for you. You are going to be able to equip your child with some things that non-divorced children may never get their hands on as far as skill sets are concerned.
Yeah.
So your child could really thrive depending on what you do with another parent who doesn't have good parenting skills.
Yeah. I mean, the standard of care that most courts adhere to is what they call good enough parenting.
Right.
And pick up the phone and call your local child protective services office and ask them what they look for in parenting. And they're probably going to tell you there's food on the table semi-regularly. The child is clothed, not always appropriately.
Right.
And there is a roof, not always the same one.
Right.
And that's sad, but if we had any higher standard, there wouldn't be enough CPS workers.
No.
To deal with the problems. If the standard were higher, a lot of really bad cases would fall through the cracks.
Yes.
Because there would be so many cases. The courts would be clogged, so clogged that truly abused children would die.
Yeah, would die. Yeah, exactly.
I'm just putting that bluntly. So you have to put that in perspective. Now, what I hate about the family court is if you have enough money.
Yeah.
And many people do.
Yeah.
You can go to court and fight about which private school is likely to harm your child the most. And the judge has to listen to it.
Right.
And that can go on for months and years. And talk about a child being permanently scarred, not by the topic, but merely by the experience of going through the conflict. So I guess the way I want to wrap this up.
Before you do that.
Oh, yes.
I have a question for you. And this just occurred to me while we were talking. Is there a correlation between the four things you've talked about and hump day topics?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to be talking about parental alienation, the trauma of false accusations, surviving the narcissistic co-parent, and confronting post-separation control and abuse. All of those are heavily laden with those four things.
Do you think it's just one, or is there overlap? Can it be two things?
Oh, there's definitely going to be overlap.
All right.
Thinking about, when you think about dealing with a narcissistic parent, co-parent, there's an element of worrying about losing myself.
Oh, definitely.
I have lost myself before with this person.
Yeah.
But there's also a strong element of, will my child be permanently scarred? More often, will my child become like the narcissist, right?
Yes.
So, you know, yeah, those are, and will they be able to go to court and lie about me? And will I lose my child?
So I might predict that all of those topics probably lean toward the probability side than the possibility.
Well, so, as you know, this is a support group, so I'm not going to be doing a lot of teaching. I'm going to be doing more listening and responding.
Right.
So I suspect the listening I'm going to be doing is about these fears. And the responding I'm going to be doing is helping them put them into categories. Are they possibilities or probabilities?
Yes. Interesting. Yeah, this could be a very useful template.
I think so.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, Danny, for your question. And as always, you can reach us at dilemma@cpdilemmas.com.
Yes, our new email address. Very good.
Yeah.
All right.
Good talking with you all.
Yep. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. Hey, listeners. You've probably heard Rick and I talk a lot about the Dragon Method of communicating with your co-parent, which is a step-by-step process to think about each conflict you have and to devise a plan to resolve it with or without your co-parent's cooperation. Many parents have told us this method, coupled with the structured email protocol, has saved their sanity. If you'd like to know more, check out our podcast companion journal called I Am Non-Impossible, a 12-week journey to co-parenting peace. You can find it on Amazon in print or Kindle formats. Just click on the link in our show notes. The information contained in this podcast is generic. It must not be misconstrued as constituting legal or psychological advice. Decisions relevant to any specific individual, family system, or case require the direct evaluation of skilled, child-centered professionals.